has forgotten to follow up on interview calls. Bye-bye, Yeltsin. On the other hand, I did take my daughter to kindergarten one day in my sweats and full TV makeup and hair, and then changed my clothes in the back of an NBC car on the way downtown for the O.J. Simpson verdict. So a normal mom, I'm not. And of course, since I'm a driven, wannabe overachiever, living with the choices I've made sometimes gives me a headache. Even after four children, I still get great assignments at work, but the fact is I don't have my own show, and I don't have that power anymore. No, that high-pitched sound you hear is not whining. Well, maybe a little bit. I still get a stomachache when I lose a big-name interview to the anchor women who are on the air more, who have their own broadcasts and therefore greater stature. I'm out of that league now, and I do get my back up when people who see me with my kids day after day ask if I'm still working. But after my resentments subside and my ego chills out, I remind myself that I'm the one who took myself out of the big league. It was my own choice, and it was right for me. Still is. To be sure, it's not always easy. I worry when I say no to a story because it requires a lot of travel. Will this be the final straw for my bosses? Each time I turn down an assignment because it conflicts with a child's special performance or a soccer game, I hold my breath for their reaction. Will they fire me now? In my desire to be at home and hands-on, I have made some pretty reckless decisions. Take the time I interviewed President Fidel Castro for a two-hour special on the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was a big deal, and NBC sent a huge team of producers and technicians to shoot it. We waited and waited, no Castro. Waited some more, no Castro. Now we were approaching the weekend. I was starting to sweat because Monday was my daughter's first day in preschool. Her father was away on location, and I'd promised her nothing would keep me from taking her. In my mind, our first child's first day at school was as important as any world event. First-time mother. But as Friday came down in Havana, we were informed that Castro was sick, under the weather, they said, and couldn't be interviewed yet. My bosses said we'd wait for him. Then on Saturday, Castro himself called me in for a meeting. I'd interviewed him before, and he wanted to tell me personally that he was still feeling sick and wouldn't be able to do the interview until Monday. My stomach tightened, and I blurted out, "I can't do that. I have to go back home and take my daughter to school." There was stone silence in the room. My boss kicked me under the table and asked me to step outside. "Are you nuts?" he asked, completely whacked out. Didn't I know how long we had worked to get this interview? Didn't I realize if I left, we would probably never get back in? Castro was so mercurial, you had to take him when you could get him. "I understood all that," I told my boss, "but I can't not go home." Looking back, my little girl probably would never have known what day the first day of school really was, but I knew. I went back inside and told Castro it was my first child and I just had to go, but I'd come right back if he would please wait. I thought my boss would have a seizure. But without skipping a beat, Castro said, "Take your daughter to school. I'll be ready next Saturday morning." And he walked out. I flew home, took her to school. She didn't cry, but I did. And returned to Cuba to shoot one of the most fascinating interviews of my career. By the way, the first thing Castro said was, "How was the first day of school?" I dodged a bullet on that one. And so my advice from the trenches is to work with your employers, if you can. Try to teach them about family-friendly policies, flexible hours, part-time work, and job sharing. If you want it but they don't get it, you might have to leave. There are too many businesses that value your family life now. And remember, even though you may think your job is your life and your identity, it's not and it shouldn't be. At work, you're replaceable. Trust me, I know what I'm talking about. But as a parent, you're irreplaceable. And by that, I mean mothers and fathers. Fathers also need to be reorganizing their lives for their children. Need I remind you, it took two of you to make the child. My husband may not have altered his career to the extent I have since we've had children, but he has made changes, and he makes sure the people he works with understand his priorities. He brings our kids to work with him whenever he can, he plays sports with them, and he has a strong and loving hand in raising them. But let me be clear. Neither of us thinks we two can raise our kids alone. I'd be dead without the participation and advice of my friends. Your friends help you, they spell you, they guide you, they cry with you when the pressure builds up. With their own children, they expand the cocoon of love and support that surrounds your family. What I said about looking for mentors in your work applies to child rearing as well. Never stop listening to good advice. Never be too smart to ask for help or so arrogant you think you can do it alone. As a matter of fact, enlarging the circle of friendship to include all the other mothers is one of the blessings that came into my life after my career supposedly went south. I'd always expected I'd be competing against women in what is still very much a man's world. I still do. But now I'm also a full-fledged member of the Sisterhood of Mothers, a gift that's enriched my life. Lesson. Children do change your career, but they also open you up in ways you never imagined. Kids teach you things about yourself you couldn't learn on your own. Lessons about patience and selflessness, love and letting go. In my life, I'd gone way past control freak all the way to control monster. But my children have taught me to let things roll off my back, to be flexible, to accept them even when they don't think, act, feel exactly as I do. I cannot control them, but I can guide and lead and honor and respect them. And believe me, they are much more fun than Boris Yeltsin. Chapter 8, Marriage is a Hell of a Lot of Hard Work. Oh my God, is that true? And I had no inkling of this when I left college. Otherwise, I wouldn't have spent my 20s worrying that I wasn't married. In fact, if any of you is worried that you haven't run into anyone named Wright, male or female, don't be in such a hurry. Chill, relax, and enjoy your freedom. Because once you're married, you don't have that kind of freedom anymore. After being in such a rush to meet their soulmates, so many people complain about being married to them. It's nuts. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm happy in my marriage, and we've been in love for more than 20 years. I married a man who recognized I was an individual first and foremost, and that my life apart from him was as important to me as our life together. I now know if I'd married someone who didn't want me to pursue my career, who didn't accept large Irish Catholic families, who wasn't crazy about kids, I'd be talking to you about divorce being a hell of a lot of work instead of marriage, which isn't to say my marriage has been easy. When I graduated from college, I dreamed not only of a fabulous career, but also a storybook wedding. Let's call it the wedding delusion. Like many young women, I just assumed if I got the right man, the gorgeous dress, the drop-dead ring, and the extravagant wedding reception, poof, a one-way ticket to happily ever after. In short, I thought if I married the right person, I had it made. What an idiot. Making a commitment on your wedding day takes one little I do. Living the commitment every day takes a lot of doing. In short, just because you know how to get married doesn't mean you know how to be married. Comedian Jay Leno once said that anyone who says their marriage is hard work probably isn't in a very good marriage. Indeed, the word work sounds like drudgery and chores, like you wouldn't do it unless you got paid and the pension benefits had better be good. But that kind of work isn't what I'm referring to in this chapter. No, my point is that marriage isn't just a state of being. It requires time and attention. It's a million separate actions taken in order to stay with someone, share a life with someone, have a partnership with someone, appreciate and support someone, cultivate love with someone. Actions taken consistently over the long haul. One thing that can kill a marriage right after the honeymoon is the prince-princess charming delusion. Do I sense a theme here? That's expecting your partner to do it all for you, make you happy, fix you, fulfill you, complete you, define you, make your life for you, make your life meaningful for you. Giant mistake. I was lucky and learned that before we got married. After a while together, my future husband said to me, "Don't expect or rely on me to make you happy." Well, I thought, isn't his grasp of the English language adorable? He doesn't realize what he's saying. Who else is supposed to make me happy if not him, I thought. But he was adamant. You must be happy with yourself first, he said. Be happy with your life separate from what the other person brings to the table. This was serious. He told me he'd be the icing on the cake, but that I shouldn't expect him to be the whole dessert. Now that definitely wouldn't make a good lyric for a romantic love song, but I knew in my gut he was right. Love lessons from the trenches. Women, don't expect a man to make your life and give you an identity. You must work at making your own life and your own identity. If you don't, I guarantee you'll have a distant, uninvolved, and resentful man on your hands, and you'll be angry because he failed to fulfill your expectations. But your problem isn't your husband. It's your unrealistic expectations. And I say here to men as well, remember, I have four brothers. Do not expect a woman to handle and arrange all the non-career areas of your life for you, as if your job is your only responsibility in the marriage. You can't opt out of all the other areas of your own life. If you think that's just too much and you can't possibly help take care of business outside of your business, think again. Because if you don't, I guarantee you'll have a stressed out, distant, and resentful woman on your hands, and you'll be angry because she failed to fulfill your expectations. But your problem isn't your wife, it's your unrealistic expectations. Men and women, there's no faster way to kill love than to blame the other party for not doing what you ought to do for yourself. To be sure, you can be blissfully happy with a partner, but you can't hold him or her responsible for making and keeping you happy. It's not fair, and it's not possible. If you set your partner up as your higher power, you'll wind up terribly disappointed and think it's their fault when it isn't. Give it up. Moving right along to happily ever after? Guess what? Not. It's another delusion that creates crazy expectations. I think I have a very strong marriage and I'm not a happy little wifey 24 hours a day. Things happen. My husband does things that tick me off, and God knows I do the same to him. There are stresses and pressures from outside that momentarily pull you apart or push you together. Even when nothing huge is happening, there are disagreements and arguments, times when you might even want to get the hell out. Life goes up and down, and so does the natural ebb and flow in a relationship. You're not supposed to be lovey-dovey all the time. What happens if you don't deal with these negative situations and feelings that inevitably come up? Well, you can numb yourself with the happily ever after delusion. Everything's great, the kids are great, he's great, I'm great, and shove any bad feelings underground. The only problem is, it doesn't work. When you eventually concede that it's not all sweetness and light, you'll think there's something irreparably wrong with your marriage. And the truly sad part is you could have been dealing with each negative feeling and situation as you went along, so the little deals wouldn't fester into a great big deal. Now, maybe you have no illusions about marriage. Maybe your parents divorced when you were a kid, so you already know that happily ever after exists only in fairy tales and movies. But many friends of mine who are children of divorce tell me that they too held on to the dream that they'd do it differently from their parents. They still wanted and expected a fairy tale. In my case, my parents just made the whole thing look easy. If they fought, and I know they just did it away from us. If they had different opinions about child rearing, they worked it out in private, and we never knew about it. Smoothly and seamlessly, they alternated between doing their own thing as individuals and operating as a couple, and we all functioned together as a family. But since they never talked about the work a marriage required, I expected that my own married life would unfold the same way, naturally, nicely, smoothly, happily. So here's my advice. If you get along with your parents and respect their opinion, ask them about the good and bad in their marriage. Ask them how kids affected their relationship. Ask them how they handled money and whether that affected the power balance between them, because it can. Ask them about religion. Ask them about everything. Pick their brain and get their wisdom. If your parents are like mine, they'll prefer not talking about any rough spots in their road. They'll try to gloss over any difficulties they might have had, perhaps out of fear you'll think less of them. Tell them you need them to be honest and open, and that you won't judge them, that you want to learn the things they wish they had known, things they might have done differently, the lessons they've learned. If your parents' marriage didn't survive, ask them why. If they've made mistakes, you can learn from them. When I meet a couple today that's been married a long time, I ask them how they do it. My husband says I'm always conducting interviews. No matter who they are, they have something to teach me. One thing I hear over and over from couples who've made it work is that you must have respect for your partner and you must be able to practice the art of forgiveness. A great girlfriend of mine is blissfully, happily married. I asked her how she does it. She told me that she and her husband practice what she calls automatic forgiveness. If one of us hurts the other's feelings or does something to infuriate the other, and that happens very often because we're sensitive to each other, then you have to get mad, let it be known, have a little or a big fight about it, and then let it go and move on. That's forgiveness. Not holding on to and cultivating the feeling that you've been wronged and then parading around like a wounded martyr. Forgiveness is not having to stay right. You can actually be right, let it be known, and then stop bludgeoning your partner with it. Let it go and move on. My friend says I keep trying to remind myself that I love this man and to get past the anger and return to the love as soon as I can. Go with the love, she says. This is how to stay married and not stay miserable. Smart, wise advice you can use, and it works. Practice being good at forgiveness before you say, I do. Also, make sure that you have a great time on your own before you get married. You'll have a great time after you get married, but it's just a different kind of great time, if you catch my drift. Enjoy your freedom. Spend as much time as you can getting to know yourself and what you want and you need. And then keep your eyes open for that great love to appear, that person who loves you for you. And by the way, make sure you love that person for him or herself too. Chances are remote, like one in a zillion, that you'll get your partner to change. They won't. Certainly the things you find most annoying and objectionable won't ever change. What does change over time is your own willingness to accept these things. And make sure you tell your partner your personal dreams for yourself and for both of you as a couple. Make sure you're on the same wavelength about kids, money, religion, and the way you want to live. But please don't expect your prospective mate to be the be-all and end-all, to have all the same interests, to want to talk about all the same things. No one person can do it all for you. Didn't you ever notice that's why you have a variety of friends? Friends are people who reflect different aspects and interests of your life. For me, there are the other mothers, the work partners, the diet buddies, the gossip hounds, the soul sisters. It's a hand-picked support network tailor-made by me, for me, especially important since I have no biological sisters. They help me with the kids, tell me I don't have to be superwoman, warn me if I'm not being true to myself, and scream that I don't have to lose another 5 pounds. Girlfriends are the ones who fill in the gaps and pick up the slack left by your primary relationship. That's what friends are for. My own life has taught me that even if you do all this work before you get married, you'll need some luck and you'll have to be willing to give 100%. Even then, your marriage might not work. If it doesn't, please don't beat yourself up about it for the rest of your life. Get help quickly so you can handle it well. A girlfriend at work did just that. She and her husband really and truly put their child's best interests first. They got help and are now great friends who share parenting, their joys, their sadnesses. They just don't share their bed. Looking back at my own life, I thank God I didn't get married until I was 30. I met my future husband when I was 21, 2 months after I got out of school. I fell in love with him immediately. More about that later on. But I still wasn't sure what I was doing and where I was going in my life. I was still scared and insecure, not yet strong enough to handle what this guy would throw my way. As I worked my way up in my career, I learned more about myself and I gained self-confidence. And as I was getting to know myself, so was he. Over several years, he actually observed what's important to me. He saw that, like him, I'm extremely ambitious, that my family is everything to me, that religion is a big part of my life. He learned that I like to talk, that I'm curious, athletic, hot-tempered, and used to getting my own way. In other words, he realized that I would be a handful as a wife. And I would have had to have been deaf, blind, and incredibly stupid not to see that he was more than a handful himself. He decided to marry me anyway. Lucky for me, my husband hasn't asked me to change. Sure, he's dropped hints that I should slow down, that I talk too much and ask too many questions, and that I'm a control freak. But he's never asked me to stop being me, and I return the favor. I practice the art of forgiveness, and so does he. We have to. There's a great deal my husband and I don't agree on. Don't even get me started on that. And no doubt it would have been easier if I had married the boy next door or even a boy from the United States. But I didn't. I fell in love with a boy from Austria who couldn't have been more different from what I imagined for myself. But I went with the love. I went with my gut, and so far, so good. Lesson. Across the years that I've worked in newsrooms, so many of my coworkers have been divorced, and to tell you the truth, that has scared me. An all-consuming career often doesn't leave room for a spouse. Today, I spend a lot of time on my marriage. I pay attention to it. I make it a priority to connect with my husband and to nurture the relationship. Please, focus on your marriage. Don't take it for granted. Choose to spend time together when you can, even on days you don't want to. Our lives are all so busy, and we can't let too many opportunities to be together slip by. That's the work part, working it in. Chapter 9. Don't expect anyone else to support you financially. Maybe you're lucky enough that your parents are rich. Maybe you'll marry into money. But please don't rely on it. Work for your money. Make your own way. Live within your means. There's nothing better for building genuine self-worth and self-respect. You might be wondering what this has to do with me or with you. You may be sitting on loans up the wazoo. You may be working full-time and going to school full-time or juggling multiple jobs to make ends meet. If that's the case, I take my hat off to you. You may not even need this chapter, but who knows? I'm one of the lucky ones whose parents paid for their college education. I got out of school knowing I wanted to work, knowing I had to work, but also knowing at least somewhere in the back of my head that I wasn't going to starve if I didn't get a job. Now, it just so happens that my passion can pay well, and I've stayed in it long enough to get one of those jobs with a big salary. And I'm doubly fortunate. Knowing my parents, I think if my passion didn't pay the bills, they would have helped me. But looking back, I'm really glad I never asked them. Instead, I learned something important, that I could take care of myself. When I started working, people assumed I didn't have to work for the money. They thought that since I was from a wealthy family, the whole work thing was just a lark. Remember that news director in Philadelphia? Then, when I got married, I can't tell you how many people thought I'd quit my job, even told me to do so, because now I'd captured a man who could support me. I can't describe how mad that made me. I remember running into a well-known agent about 6 months after I got married when I'd started my new job at NBC after the CBS Morning News went down the tubes. He kissed me hello, asked me about the new network, then shook his head and said, "I don't know why you bother with all that network news crap. You married a rich guy. Sit back, enjoy, have a few babies and a nice life." I wanted to punch that guy's lights out. I'm glad I didn't because he wasn't the last one to say it, and you can't punch everybody's lights out. Like many women, I did not get married to live off my husband. I did not go into the television news business for the money. In fact, when I went into the business, the pay was nothing like it is today. I work because I love it, and I love earning my own money. It makes me feel strong and independent to know I can make my own way financially. If you want to feel emotionally independent, knowing you can earn your own money is key. My regret in this area is that I never took the time to be really smart about finances. Advice from the trenches, don't do what I did. I never paid attention to what I was doing with what I was earning. When I graduated, most of the women in my class didn't talk about money. We had it or we didn't have it. Either way, we didn't even think about it. I was never great in math, so I just assumed some guy would take care of it for me or that it would magically take care of itself. Big mistake. This is definitely something I would change about my life. I would make sure that from the outset, I spent as much time learning how to handle my finances as I did climbing up the career ladder. In this day and age, it's really stupid to be stupid about financial matters. It doesn't do you any good to make the money if you don't know what to do with it other than spend it. A girlfriend of mine who has earned more money than God shared some great advice she got at the beginning of her career from a well-known old entertainer. He said that no matter how wealthy she got, she should go over every one of her canceled checks with an eagle eye. He said it would make her smart about money, make her aware of where her money was going, and what she wanted it to do for her. That's advice from an extremely wealthy person. For the rest of us, we have to pay attention. Now that I'm making good money, it's become a real issue for me. I'm trying to get smart about money management, estate planning, you name it. I'm playing catch-up in a world that is changing and moving so rapidly, it's hard not to feel like I'm always behind the curve. I don't think I'll ever have fluency in this area, and it really ticks me off. So please be smarter than I was, especially you women. Don't just assume that a man will take care of this for you. If you take time off from your career or leave it entirely to take care of your children, please don't check out of this arena. You never know if you'll be blindsided by life and thrown into a situation where you'll have to know how to take care of yourself. And believe me, learning about this stuff takes time, and the people who can teach us aren't always so patient with those of us who are idiots about it. Advice from the trenches. Learn about money and talk openly about it in your relationship. Now, I do very well in the salary department, but as you know, my husband does a lot better. He says he doesn't have more power in our marriage because of it, but I think he does. I don't want to ask him for money, and I don't. Probably sounds crazy, but that's just my pet peeve. He's incredibly generous and always says it's our money, but I just like knowing that I can bring home the bacon too. I just wish I were as smart about business as he is. Another thing about making your own money, there may come a time in the not-too-distant future when you'll want to or have to help your parents financially. If you're smart about your money now and bust your butt and get lucky, you'll be able to. Very few things are as satisfying as being able to help your family with money that you've earned. One final note. You may not think it right now, but I bet you won't need all the money you'll earn. I bet there'll always be some part of your income that you can give to charity. Start doing that right away so it's a habit. I admire the well-known sports agent who will not sign players unless they agree to give 10% of their income to charity. I also admire a young woman who helps me with my kids. She's Mormon and has always given 10% of her earnings to her church. She never thinks about it, just plans for it and does it. I greatly respect her and so many other young people I've met who start with that kind of good heart right out of the gate. I believe it comes back to you tenfold in spiritual gifts, like gratitude, self-worth, and peace of mind. Lesson. Money gives you options, but only if you don't fritter it away. Pay attention to where your money is going so it can help you get where you're going. And remember, you may never be able to have it all, but it's good for the soul to give some of what you do have away. Chapter 10, Laughter. Gotta have laughter. It's the last item on my list, but it's the one that makes the first nine doable. Life isn't smooth, but you can survive the kinks and curves by laughing at them and yourself. People always ask me what attracted me to my husband. It was his sense of humor. Take my advice, pick your partner not only for the lust, but for the laughter. Trust me, you'll need humor much more than you'll need money, a great job, a fabulous wardrobe, or even being thin. The first day I met my husband, he said something totally irreverent and funny to my mother. Most people are terrified of my mother. But when he was introduced to her, he said, "Your daughter has such a great ass." I don't know how he gets away with that kind of thing, but my mother laughed her head off. This was at a pro celebrity tennis tournament more than two decades ago. He wasn't a celebrity yet, but he was something of a cult figure. My brother suggested it would be cool to have this amazing professional bodybuilder play against the pros. He had a blast. He poked fun at himself, his thick accent, his Middle European wardrobe, his lack of tennis talent. I laughed so hard, I fell in love. Everyone I knew was quite sure I was just being rebellious, infatuated with how different he was. All I knew was that every time we got together, we had so much fun. He was smart, ambitious, eager to learn, and he helped me to take myself, my heritage, and my destiny far less seriously. By now, we've been together for more than 22 years. Of course, it hasn't always been fun, because life isn't always fun. But I can honestly say no one else can make me laugh more than he does. No one else I know looks at life quite the way he does. Today, whenever our lives feel pressured, whenever he gets to raging about whatever reversal or frustration, and he does that a lot, I say, "Where's your sense of humor? I can't believe you're not making me laugh about this." He usually takes the cue and bounces back. I don't know anyone who has more fun than my husband. He works like a dog, but he's got a wonderful ability to turn it off and go play. He surrounds himself with people who make him laugh, mostly guys who get nuts with those stupid macho jokes I just don't get. And he immerses himself in hobbies that he enjoys. As a matter of fact, I get great joy teasing him about his hobbies, riding motorcycles with the boys, shooting pool with the boys, smoking cigars with the boys, skiing and hiking with the boys, and most recently, playing the dreaded golf with the boys. I tell him that all these things take him away from me, that he's just being selfish, as if it were desirable to be miserable together. I needle him that the only reason he gets to enjoy himself is because I hold down the fort with the kids. The truth is, I give my husband grief because I'm jealous he's figured out a way to live his life so that he still has loads of laughs. He's just done a better job managing his time and being able to say no to things he doesn't want to do. This one is a big issue for most women. The truth is, I know many more men than women who are able to steal time away for themselves. Well, that's the female propaganda anyway. Here's the truth about women. We have our own secret hobby, and that's stealing away time to gab. This is one of our greatest pleasures, and we never deny it to ourselves. Girlfriends make each other laugh. We laugh about our own situations and frustrations. We laugh about our kids, but mainly we laugh about our guys, like the way they stroll around those big green fields telling dirty jokes and chasing after little white balls. Laughter infuses your life with joy. Believe me when I tell you, I know so many people my age, which is not that old, who've lost the joy in their lives. Life's awesome responsibilities have a way of creeping up on you, wearing you down, making you dead serious, robbing you of laughter and joy. I hear it from people my age all the time. They say, I'm not having fun anymore. I can't remember the last time I laughed until I cried. I can't remember the last time I felt free. They let the joy go. Remember back to the first chapter where I talked about pinpointing your passion? I told you one of the things that fed my passion for the news was how much fun the boys in the back of the campaign plane were having. I hope there are people in your workplace who make you laugh. I hope you can see the humor in your changing situation as you scoot up that ladder. Remember my first producer at CBS News, my mentor? Well, I told you how nuts she was, but I probably didn't do her sense of humor justice, or her laugh. She has one of the most outrageous, loudest laughs I've ever heard. The more insane the situation, the funnier she makes it. And we laugh so much working together that the old cameraman, the one who blistered my hide for making that little speech in the trailer park, used to call us Fluffy and Flaco. We never could figure out which one of us was which, and we laughed about that too. We had a lot to laugh about. Just one story. Finding ourselves in a huge crush of cameras and reporters, in our business we call it a gangbang, I'm sorry to say, at the Cannes Film Festival, the European press corps was chasing after Robert De Niro, who had no intention of being interviewed. My producer was mortified to be caught up in the crush for an entertainment story, for God's sake. After all, she was training me to be a hard news Hannah, and this was years before OJ and Di and Monica. But we got swept up in the competition of it, pushing and shoving, and I actually found myself crawling on all fours under a table and popping up right next to Mr. De Niro. My producer shoved our cameraman across the table into De Niro's face and asked him the stupidest thing I'd ever heard come out of her mouth. So, do you like your movie? We both broke up. De Niro did not. We felt so bad about ourselves, we washed it away in rivers of laughter. You have to laugh at yourself if you do something stupid or jerky, especially if that's the only way you're going to get a laugh that day at all. I've laughed my way through all my ups and downs in television news. In fact, I've laughed on the air when I shouldn't have. The first time I anchored the CBS Morning News, sort of an audition, I was so nervous that I spent the previous minutes before the show dry heaving in the bathroom. What is it with my stomach? I had no idea how to anchor, and true to the news biz, nobody told me how either. I was supposed to do the top of the show. The lead stories were strung together on videotape, and I was to read the headlines that went with the pictures. But I was so nervous, I raced through the headlines like a maniac, paying no attention to what pictures were showing when. I finished talking way too early, and as I saw the pictures continuing to play silently on the monitor, proceeded to laugh my head off on the air. I guess that didn't bother anyone because I got the job, which tells you something. One morning, I was to interview our top Middle East correspondent about some burning situation in that part of the world. During the commercial before our segment, I told him that when we were done, he should get out of the way because we would be going straight to another segment. And he did. When we finished our interview, as I turned to the second camera for the next intro, I could see our distinguished veteran war correspondent out of the corner of my eye, crawling on his hands and knees under the cameras to get off the set. I broke out into peals of laughter and couldn't stop. On the air. I have so many memories that make me laugh. Back to Cuba. The first time I was there, I remember standing next to Castro while he screamed bloody murder at me in rapid-fire Spanish, because the week before, the NBC Nightly News had done a story about a Cuban landing strip being used for drug trafficking. It was all I could do to not burst out laughing. Here was a head of state in fatigues with high-heeled combat boots, standing in a beaten-down shack in Havana, screaming to me in a language I didn't understand about editorial policy I didn't make thousands of miles away in Rockefeller Center. I don't know if I wanted to laugh because it seemed funny or to relieve the tension. In fact, I did laugh. If you ever find yourself in a similar situation, I don't recommend it. I've been blessed to have been able to work with so many funny people. They may not always know they're being funny, but by and large, the people in my profession have a great sense of humor. Trust me, when you're racing against demon deadlines, doing live shots from crime scenes or conventions or courtrooms, facing crushing competition, always trying to do the impossible in an impossible time frame, you need people around you who can laugh, because otherwise everything gets so life and death serious it can make you sick. I've asked myself where I learned to be both so ambitious and driven on the one hand and so willing to laugh at myself on the other. I think I figured it out. My mother. My mother made it very clear to me that it was a man's world and it was no use complaining about it. From the time I was little, she pushed me to do whatever my brothers did. Just get in there, Maria. Get in there and do it. If it was a boys-only football game, she made sure I played, no matter how disgusted they were at the prospect. But really, it was up to me to participate. Get in there, Maria, get in there and play, she pushed me, and I'd shove my way in. For a long time, my brothers wouldn't throw the football to me. They barely talked to me in the huddle. They just told me each time that I'd be the hiker, the one who passed the ball between my legs to a brother who would then get to put it into play. They liked that because they made fun of my butt sticking up into the air. The play swirled all around me, but no matter, my mother said I was really in the game, and that was what was important. After what seemed like several years of football games, they finally threw the ball to me and tackled me. At last. It wasn't all that different from when they'd pile on me and tickle me to distraction. But I was playing football. I was so bad at the game compared to them, I had to laugh at myself. They certainly did. And I grew up with that voice in my ear. Get in there, Maria. Just get in there and do it. And also the sound of laughter. Me laughing at my own nerve. The lesson I learned was to take what I do seriously, but not take myself so seriously. Sometime when you have a free moment, write down what has given you joy in your life. What have you been happiest doing? What's been fun? What has made you laugh till you cried? Keep that paper and look at it every couple of years. You'll be surprised how quickly you forget to do those things. So caught up are you in getting ahead and taking yourself too seriously. When you feel a lack of laughs in your life, look at your list and do one of the things on it. Put some of the joy back in. I did something like that last year. I felt I was missing the fun I'd experienced in my 20s and figured I needed an attitude adjustment. So I sat down and asked myself, what did I do back then that made me so happy? What made me laugh? To be honest, some of the things I couldn't do again, and I won't get into what those were. But I remembered what a great time I used to have playing sports. So I've started riding again and playing a little tennis. And I remember how much I laughed when I spent time with my brothers and my cousins. So I've made a point to schedule family vacation time every summer with them back east where I grew up. That week of laughter feeds my soul all year long. And instead of blowing off my high school reunion, I went to it and laughed at memories with old girlfriends. And I've been reminding myself about having more humility. I find when I have an accurate picture of myself and accept and appreciate where I am in my life and where I still want to go, that's when I have the perspective and attitude that allows me to enjoy myself and have a good laugh. Lesson. When I was a girl, if you told me I'd be married to an Austrian-born Republican bodybuilder whose big breakthrough was playing Conan the Barbarian, I would have laughed out loud. But that's what happened, and I'm still laughing. The love and the laughter are what you need most in your life. They'll fill out all the potholes in the road. And that's my top 10 list of things I wish I'd known. My report from the fighting front as a college graduate making it day by day out there in the real world. I wish I could tell each and every one of you that you'll achieve greatness in whatever you do. Let me be the first to tell you, you may not. But you can achieve happiness and a rich life by taking your time, keeping it simple, and getting down on your knees every once in a while to thank God for what you have and to ask Him for the faith, love, guidance, and humility we all need to get through this life. As you step out of college into the rest of your lives, I know you're wondering whether that jittery feeling in your gut is excitement or just plain fear of the future. Believe me, it's fear. Fear of the unknown and fear of failure in love and in life. It's all right and perfectly normal and natural to be anxious about what's around the corner. But never let that stop you from looking around the corner to see what's there for you. Each and every one of you is an awesome, powerful, resilient human being, capable of living the life you designed for yourself. It's within you to carve out your own future, create your own destiny. You're in a glorious moment filled with possibility. Try to keep this feeling of endless possibility alive as long as possible. Whenever you feel it fading, call it back and renew it. That's a gift you can give yourself. You deserve to feel great about your life. Someone wise once told me that courage is walking through your fear with faith. I wish all of you the faith and the courage to pinpoint your passion. Now go out there, be free, and achieve it. Congratulations. Afterward. I gave that speech and wrote this book so that you might be spared. Not spared from having to learn the lessons I had to learn. No one can spare you that, because learning is experiential, and you have to do it yourself. As a wise person once told me, and it was actually the same wise person as before, if I could spare you the pain you're experiencing, I wouldn't, because I wouldn't want to deprive you of the strength and the wisdom you'll get from having gone through it and come out the other side. So what I wish to spare you is the loneliness and shame I had. I thought I was the only one who kept starting at the bottom. I thought I was the only one who was scared. I thought I was the only one who'd ever failed. I thought I was the only one who couldn't be Superwoman. Now you know that these things happen. They're normal. When you experience failure or rejection or disappointment, you'll be able to tell yourself, I haven't crashed into a brick wall. I've only hit a speed bump. You can survive and move on. I did, and that's the message of hope I hope to pass along to you. If I can do it, you can do it too. Everybody's tragedies are their own. If you're smart and keep your eyes and ears open, you'll hear the stories of people who have survived the unimaginable, who've persevered and endured, despite the loss of loved ones, despite sickness, divorce, bankruptcy, addiction, you name it. If they can do it, I can do it too. You know, after I gave that speech, I came up with a list of other things I wish I'd known. I wish I'd known that in the scheme of things, a big expensive wedding is a silly waste of time and money and angst. I wish I'd known how easy it is to lose touch with your college friends. Before you know it, 20 years have gone by and you let your pals slip away. Try not to let that happen to you. I wish I'd known that computers were going to rule the world. I would have tried for mastery sooner. I wish I'd known how creative, crucial, and consistent sex would have to be, and I certainly never knew I'd wind up talking about it so much. I wish I'd known how quickly careers take over your life. I dove into mine right after college. I wish I'd taken a year off just to play around, a year with no responsibilities, no deadlines, no goals. Once you're trying to make it, you can't be carefree like that again. I wish I'd known how important my health would be. I'd have taken better care of myself earlier. Now that we know we can learn and grow and change in our 40s and 50s and way beyond, it's a crime to let our bodies deteriorate from neglect or misuse. I wish I'd learned earlier about the simplicity movement. very wise people who are simplifying their lives by finding quiet corners where they can contemplate what's really important, then shed the excess. Maybe I couldn't really do that until I'd cluttered up my life so much it required cleaning out. I wish I'd known earlier how to say no. What I'm realizing is that really smart people don't burden themselves with guilt. They're comfortable saying, nope, I can't do one more thing. They just manage their time very well. They do not do it all, but whatever they do do, they do well. This is my goal for today. I wish I'd known how transforming the love is a parent feels for a child. I would have been a different child to my parents, kinder, more open, sharing more with them. In my self-seeking, I turned away from them too quickly and easily. Now I've learned that kids can hurt your feelings very deeply. The other day, my younger daughter said, Mommy, you're going to have to go out and get your own play dates because we've been playing with you too much. We want to play with our own friends more. That cut me to the quick. I wish I'd known, too, how difficult it was for my parents to watch me marry and move 3,000 miles away. I'm already preparing myself to be as gracious, loving, and generous when one of my kids does something like that to me down the road. I wish I'd known my parents when they were young. I met these two extraordinary individuals when they were halfway through their lives. I wish I'd been able to experience them before they were saddled with us kids. I wish I'd known my four brothers would end up being my best friends. I would have hit them less when we were kids, thrown them out of my room less, and dismissed and discounted them less. Today, they're not just wallpaper. They are a crucial part of my life, always there. I don't take their love for granted. We've worked deliberately and hard to create our own separate relationships apart from our parents, and that's become more crucial as we've aged. As a matter of fact, we make it a point a couple of times a year to get together, just the five of us in a room, to find out where each of us is and how we're really doing, to clear up any resentments or misunderstandings, to just be there for each other. My family relationships, nurtured in my adulthood, are the backbone of my life, the skeleton that the rest of it hangs on. I wish I'd known earlier in my life the importance of saying, I love you. You'd be surprised how many people don't really know how much they're loved. I've learned to say it to my kids, my husband, my parents, my brothers, whenever I get that feeling in my heart. I also tell my friends that I love them, that they're important to me, and I'm grateful for their friendship. You know, I've learned a terrible truth from going to too many funerals in my life. So much of the praise comes after people are gone, in their eulogies. We ought to be telling them sooner. So I'm a big believer in toasting people at birthdays and anniversaries, family gatherings, special celebrations, toasting their great qualities, their friendships, their wisdom, their uniqueness. What could be better than being told out loud in a genuine way, with other people listening, that you are loved, respected, needed, appreciated, and adored? I wish I'd known that I possessed all the strength and faith I needed to go through some of my own tough times. My husband's open-heart surgery, the death of close relatives, the illness of children. Perhaps I wouldn't have been so afraid. I wish I'd known how often I'd have to reinvent myself. Here I had focused all my energy and juice on becoming the best newswoman I could possibly be, and boom, at the age of 43, my interests changed dramatically. I woke up one day and wrote a children's book. Suddenly, I was an author, a new identity for me, and I was starting over again. It reinvigorated me, got me excited again, passionate again. And here I am now writing yet another book. I really wish I'd known there isn't just one answer to the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because it turns out I grew up to be a hard-driving career woman in my 20s, a wife and mother in my 30s, and all that plus an author in my 40s. I'm grateful I've gotten in touch with the part of us that's teachable and renewable, fresh and growing. We can reinvent ourselves and find a whole new world out there, or a whole new world within ourselves, over and over again. I wish I'd known how to be at peace with myself sooner. I don't think I was ever truly proud of myself until one day in April 1999, when I learned both that I'd won a Peabody Award for broadcast journalism and that my children's book had made the New York Times bestseller list. I sat in my hotel room and wept. After 43 years on this planet, I felt I'd accomplished something. I was being recognized not for my family or my husband or my looks, but for myself and my own hard work. It told me I had a right to be proud of myself. Finally. Okay, now I'm totally sick of talking about myself. Go take what I've learned and run with it. I'll get back to you in a decade or so and give you an update. God bless you and good luck. Acknowledgements. I could not have done this book without the wisdom, brilliance, guidance, and support and love of my mentor and dear friend, Roberta Hollander. She spent countless hours helping me in every way imaginable. She jogged my memory, tightened and polished my work, helped me put it all in context, and pushed me forward when I doubted myself and my thoughts. She has been my guiding light since I met her, and I am grateful beyond words to her for always, always, always stopping and being there for me. I'm also indebted to my other pals who read this book in its roughest form and offered me encouragement and constructive criticism. They all played an invaluable part in the outcome. So thank you again, dearest Julia Page, for all of your encouragement, telling me on a daily basis that I must write this book. To Nadine Schiff, Wanda McDaniel, Michael Rourke, your suggestions made it all better. To Terry Hess, who went through it with a fine-tooth comb. To Jan Miller, the most dedicated and fearless of agents, and to her assistant, Shannon Miser Marvin, who works on my behalf behind the scenes. To Rick Horgan, who pursued this book before it was a book and waited patiently for me while I hemmed and hawed about whether I wanted to write it. And finally, to all my new friends at Warner Books, I thank you for your support, your belief in me, and for all the money that you've promised to spend on this great little book of mine.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of 10 Things I Wish I'd Known Before I Went Out into the Real World, written and read by Maria Shriver. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. Production coordinated by Daniel Metcalf. Tape edited, mixed, and mastered by Rick Dasher, North Hollywood Sound.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.